Welcome to the Crexie Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In each episode, the Crexie team connects with featured CRE experts to investigate trends, educate listeners, and understand the latest industry news. As the nation's fastest growing online CRE platform, we're excited to provide a window into the inner workings of commercial real estate for this generation and the next.
Welcome, and thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Crexie Podcast, an insider's look at all things commercial real estate. In this show, we cover a broad range of topics that cater to CRE newcomers and industry leaders alike. I'm your host, Taylor Curtis, and today we are thrilled to sit down with Matt Aitchison, founder and CEO of Imagos Hospitality Group. A little bit about our guest. Matt Aitchison is an esteemed boutique hotelier, commercial real estate investor, and highly sought-after speaker within the real estate industry. With an impressive background that encompasses diverse accomplishments, Matt's journey began after graduating from UC Santa Barbara, where he embarked on a successful career in real estate sales. Through unwavering determination and work ethic, he cultivated a top 1,000 real estate team in the U.S. as recognized by the Wall Street Journal. Quickly understanding that traditional real estate sales alone wouldn't unlock his desired financial freedom goals, Matt pivoted and went all in on commercial real estate investing full-time. Since then, he has amassed extensive experience flipping and wholesaling hundreds of houses while concurrently scaling his passive income portfolio. After shifting his focus full-time to commercial real estate and hospitality assets, his portfolio now encompasses real estate strip centers, medical plazas, apartment buildings, and hotels. Presently, Matt is the founder and CEO of Imagos Group, which specializes in the innovation and evolution of boutique hotels and commercial real estate assets, in addition to hosting a top 100 ranked business podcast in the world. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to being here with you guys.
Of course. And our listeners are very thrilled to have you as well. I know we just covered a little bit about your background, but would love to learn more about your career path and the lessons you've learned along the way. So kind of diving in, can you tell us more about where you're from and just how you got your start in commercial real estate?
Yeah, I mean, like most people who get into, you know, real estate investing, I knew that I wanted to be my own boss. I wanted to have the flexibility and freedom of my own schedule to make an impact in other people's lives. And at the same time, I wanted to be in a space that allowed me to build wealth and kind of unlock, you know, that, that freedom. So when I graduated with my expensive piece of paper from UC Santa Barbara, I had an opportunity to work for my first mentor, kind of taking over his book of business in an insurance company that I was working for while I was in college. And I just realized it was not something I was passionate about. And so I ended up moving back to Sacramento, where I was born and raised. And I was interviewing at all of these places that, you know, were essentially going to pay me $35,000, $45,000 a year. And I was like, yeah, this is not going to get me to where I want to go. And so I came across a Craigslist ad one day, if you can believe that. And it was back in 2010, post-financial crisis, when in Northern California, there was foreclosures everywhere. And so there was a Craigslist ad that said, real estate mentor seeks mentee. And I called this guy. Long story short, I ended up interning for this guy who was flipping a lot of houses at the time for a year. And I worked for him for free. And I saw how much money he was making, or that I was making him. I was doing all the project management. I was doing all of the flipping. And essentially, he was clipping $50,000, $60,000 a flip. I was making nothing, but it was the best time for me to get exposure to a path that really I saw myself pursuing. And that led me to buying my very first flip house, which was the neighborhood cat lady house. And when I purchased that house, I think it was a hoarder's house too. We ended up rehousing over 100 cats. We found 3 dead cats under trash. We found 1 dead raccoon in her house. But I ended up making $106,000 net on that very first flip, using 100% of other people's money. and I was 21 years old. Mm-hmm. And to me, you know, going from being broke, living at home, to now finding what I thought was a path and a vehicle for, you know, getting me on track with my goals and my dreams that I, you know, initially thought were possible. That led me to flipping a bunch of houses over the next 5-6 years. And then I started working with some hedge funds and wholesaling them houses. And then I started realizing that I was, you know, making good income, but I was only as good as my last flip. And so I really wanted to start thinking about, you know, how I can generate some more passive income and get a higher ROI in my time and my skill set. And that led me to start buying my first duplex and then fourplex. And then ultimately, on accident, I got into commercial real estate. I bought my very first neighborhood strip center from a broker who knew I was buying a lot of real estate. He asked me if I wanted to buy this little neighborhood, you know, retail plaza, which was very close to where I'd lived. And I figured, what better way to cut my teeth and get into something? Of course I can do it. There's, you know, it's got to be the same as single family real estate. Long story short, I learned a ton on that deal. And that led into my next commercial purchase, which then led into my first hotel purchase, which was on accident as well. It was brought to me through a social media follower that actually somebody in their church had owned this little hotel up in Lake Tahoe, and they were not real estate investors. They thought it would be a great idea to have it be a property for the church to use. It didn't, you know, work out and go according to plan. So I bought this property, essentially like going into foreclosure, thinking that it was going to be just like another house flip, right? How hard can it be to buy and flip and manage and operate a hotel, which I'm sure we'll dig into a little bit more later. But my start in commercial real estate happened totally by accident. That being said, you know, when you're consistently taking action on your goals and, you know, trying to figure out what path and vehicle, you know, best aligns with your goals, that naturally progressed into leading me towards commercial real estate. And, you know, the rest is kind of history.
Yeah, that's awesome. And something you talk about a lot on your podcast too is the 500K passive income plan. Can you share a little bit more about what that is for our listeners?
Yeah, so when I was, you know, I had a bunch of single family houses that were making me $200-$300 a month in passive income. But my goal was to get to $500,000 a year in passive income. And I wanted to do that by the time I was 40. And when I started thinking about this, I was like in my late 20s. And I was going, man, if I want to get to $500,000 a year in passive income by the time I'm 40, and I'm investing in these types of properties that make me this net passive income every month, I am going to have to buy a lot of single family houses. And at that time, I realized I don't want to have to do more volume and manage more properties and more tenants and more stress. I want to really start to get more strategic and looking at what is the asset class that aligns with my goals, that actually generates the income that I want to make. And so that led me down the rabbit hole of going, by the time I'm 30, I want to buy just one commercial real estate property a year that nets me $50,000 a year. And if I can just do one a year for the next decade, I can unlock that $500,000 a year in passive income goal, let alone, right, the cost segregation and tax depreciation and the equity growth that comes along with that. And so it became somewhat of a math equation of going, I know that I can do one transaction a year. And therefore, I just need to find the asset class and the market and the team that will allow me to spit out that 50K a year when all is said and done. And that ultimately led me to kind of formulating my passive income plan, which is what I've been executing on over the last 7 years. When I first started it, when I was 29, and now I'm going to be turning 36 this year.
Oh, that's amazing. Well, happy early birthday. When you break down the model too, like what are the benefits of commercial real estate as a wealth driver versus other vehicles that are out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people think that commercial real estate is so much more complex than it is. Actually, in my opinion, it's a lot easier than single family. It's got much higher income potential, a much higher ROI in your time invested into these projects, a much higher ROI in your skill set. And single family, you know, real estate skills actually transition extremely well into commercial real estate. You know, a lot of commercial real estate is less management intensive outside of hotels. and, you know, the scale of investment returns, having the ability to do value add opportunities and really, you know, capture, you know, equity that you can force into these assets and then exchange into larger, you know, properties, the tax savings and depreciation opportunities through cost segregation. A lot of these things you just can't maximize to the capacity you can in commercial as you can in single family. And so that really kind of led me into, you know, exploring what commercial real estate could look like for myself. And, you know, just like I'm sure the first time you sit down and play Monopoly, you're wondering, you know, what do these pieces do? What if I land here? What's the strategy of winning this game, right? But if you play Monopoly, you know, 50 times, you go, okay, I know how to win the game. I know what properties I should be buying. I know what the strategy is. I know who I'm playing against. And that's ultimately what commercial real estate is as well. It's, you know, sitting down to a new game and understanding the rules, the strategies, the landscape. And once you do that enough, you know, things really start to slow down. But the upside that you can get by playing this game versus single family is so much far greater.
Yep, absolutely. And when it comes to better understanding it too, and it sounds like a lot of the career moves you made getting into residential or getting into commercial, you know, with your first strip center and then the first hotel was kind of, you know, you stumbled upon it or it wasn't, you know, it was by accident. So along the way, who were some of the mentors that kind of shaped your career path, whether that being, you know, in the beginning of your career and even now present day too, you know, who continues to shape that?
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I've always committed to is, you know, just staying in a constant state of curiosity. I always say, you know, I'm a student of life and I'm always looking for my next teacher. I'm always looking for mentors, whether that's in marriage and parenting and, you know, being a better real estate investor. And I have been somebody, I always, you know, when people ask me about how I've had success in my career, specific to my own journey, I've always told people I'm just dumb enough to believe in myself and smart enough to take action every day. And that has allowed me to just stay humble and consistent in my action and constantly looking for ways to add value and bring value to other people. And that's led me to finding some really great mentors at different stages of, you know, my career, my journey. And, you know, fortunately, I was early on in my real estate career, I was making great money. I didn't have kind of a real estate portfolio yet. And I went to a mastermind. Which, you know, I'm a big believer in you grow into the conversations and the environments that you put yourself in. You hang around, you know, nine people that are complainers, that are victims, that are, you know, not taking action or doing unhealthy habits or things, you're probably going to become the 10th. You also put yourself around, you know, nine other millionaires that are being productive and resourceful and, you know, adding value to one another and having success, you're probably going to become the 10th just like they are as well. And so by getting in these mastermind groups, I really met a lot of mentors who were way further down the path than me. And I'm a big believer in masterminds being kind of like the barrel of monkeys. If you remember that old game with the plastic monkeys that have one arm up and one arm down, right? Those monkeys are always one hand up looking to elevate themselves and get pulled up by somebody else. And also one hand down to, you know, share that value and bring other people up with you. And masterminds kind of became that ecosystem where I was able to kind of create my own barrel of monkeys. And probably one of the first lessons that really impacted me that kind of got my sights set on leveraging real estate to kind of unlock financial freedom was this idea and concept of becoming a 100%er. How do you buy assets and invest in things that generate enough passive income where 100% of that passive income covers 100% of your lifestyle, you know, cost of living? And so for me, that kind of became target number one is, hey, if my, you know, lifestyle, my expenses, my mortgage, my date nights, you know, my kids, my groceries, my electric bill, whatever it may be, you know, all of those expenses, 100% of the passive income that my assets generate cover that, you're essentially free, right? Financially free. Yep. And so for me, this idea of making good vertical income is great. I knew a lot of people that were rich on paper, but they had no assets that really unlocked that time freedom for them. So then the focus really shifted for me towards how do I generate, you know, more vertical income where I'm actually trading my time for money. I got to show up to make that paycheck, but then I can leverage that income into horizontal income assets, which was more of the passive vehicles. And to me, that really was a big game changer for me, because then it just became a game and starting to figure out how do I put the stepping stones in place to become a 100%er to where I can have that time freedom back. I can have that financial freedom, and I can ultimately start moving the needle forward towards, you know, generating more horizontal income and mailbox money that I didn't necessarily have to show up and grind my butt off for every single day. The other part of it too was, you know, because I was fortunate enough to have mentors at such a young age, the beautiful part is I have time. You know, I'm 35 years old, and, you know, when I first started joining masterminds, I was in my early 20s. So I was able to get people to implant the seed into my mind that ultimately when you play the long game, which you know it's going to be a marathon, yes, there's going to be a lot of strategic sprints in that, I was able to kind of adopt this crockpot mindset versus the microwave mindset, which a lot of people in real estate, they want the quick hits of cash. I'm going to get rich overnight. Yep. I'm going to become a millionaire through real estate in 6 months.
Right.
And my thing was, I'm just going to be slow and steady and know that, hey, the crockpot takes some time for the ingredients to fuse together to create that great dish. But when it does, it's way better than what you're going to get in the microwave. And so just having the foundational mindset to know that this is going to be a long journey and to live below my means and to be surrounded by people that were way further down the path than me was absolutely critical in setting me up for success in the long run.
Yep. I love that. I love that analogy. That's so fun. And I also love the point you brought up earlier too about, you know, being very mindful and intentional of who you're surrounding yourself by. I think the classic phrase always goes, you know, you're a sum of the five closest people next to you. So it's incredible how you've been able to kind of identify, you know, who falls into the bucket of somebody that you want to embody more, you know, things like, and being able to surround yourself around them and like take little tidbits and kind of work that into your process as well.
Yep.
What lessons do you think early on were most crucial to your career?
You know, I think for me, the, you know, some of the things that I just mentioned were really important is really understanding that this is a game of stamina. And and when you think of the people that are the wealthiest or that you look at the overnight success stories, you know, these are individuals that have had the most failures and had the most sleepless nights and the ones that have taken the risks and, you know, put themselves out there in a capacity that most other humans haven't. Doesn't make them any better, right? But in the wealth building game, these are individuals that are constantly failing forward and failing up. And so for me, it was how quickly can I fail? And I'm a very reflective person. One of the things that I learned early on is that, you know, some of the most successful people, they're not the sharpest tools in the shed. They're not the most skilled, but they are individuals that have this heightened awareness around where they're doing really well and where their blind spots are at and where they're not crushing it and constantly tweaking and adjusting and optimizing very frequently and consistently. So that became something that I knew I needed to build the right habits, the right mindset, the right discipline, you know, for my personal life that would then show up in my business. And I've always believed in the quote, you know, your business, your wealth grows to the extent that you do. So I was constantly, you know, in this state of trying to, I was almost in crisis every time to find a way to break through to a next level. And I think, you know, when you think about the greatest leaders, business owners, investors, they are constantly in crisis to get to the next level. And by doing that, it forces them to metamorphosize themselves into somebody smarter, wiser, stronger, you know, more capable. And the only way I could do that was consistently putting myself in uncomfortable situations. So that has been something that has been, you know, a great foundation of growth for me. And then just honestly, my network, you know, being able to tap into other people's, you know, Rolodex of relationships that took them 20 or 30 years to build, to be able to tap into other people's resources, to be able to tap into other people's wisdom. Those were things that really helped accelerate, you know, my learning curve to help me avoid mistakes that I probably would have made if I was trying to do all this on my own. Yeah. And so I have been fortunate enough to have some very wise and successful mentors. And, you know, I often get the question a lot is, well, what made those people want to invest in you? Or how did you get around some of those people?
Mm-hmm.
And I have over the years asked more and more of my mentors, why are you doing this for me? Or how the heck did I get in this room? Like, you know, there's a bunch of billionaires or 500 why millionaires me? In this room, and I'm, you know, nowhere close to that. Why me? And I have noticed you look at this the same way when I invest in mentoring in people, and the same response has been given to me and why people invest in me. And I think this is something that anybody can rinse and repeat in their own world, which I call it the likability formula. And the likability formula, in my opinion, kind of consists of these variables in the equation, which is number one, you're humble. There's so many people that love to be flaunt and flashy and just talk about how great they are. And at the end of the day, if you're great, you don't need to talk about it. Your results and your character and who you are and how you carry yourself will, you know, stand on its own two feet. So I've always been a big believer in just like, don't read your own press clippings, right? Just stay humble and have your head down. And that's something that I think a lot of people resonate with and enjoy. The other side of it is if you pair humility with confidence. Hey, I'm humble, but I'm also confident in who I am, how I show up, what I'm capable of, even if I don't know these things, right? I'm gonna be confident in my ability to bring value and to show up in a way that ultimately, you know, moves the needle forward in what it is that I'm trying to do. And then the third piece of it is when you are insanely hardworking, work ethic can overcome so many things that others can't. And my belief is that, you know, all of my other shortcomings that I thought that I had, right, I needed to have more money or I needed to be taller or stronger or this or that. Yeah. I knew that over the course of my life, hard work validated, I could achieve and overcome a lot of the hurdles that most people use as excuses not to start or to not to do something. So when you pair humility with confidence, with a consistent and insane work ethic, those types of people, I don't know about you, but when I'm around those types of people, I'm like, man, I like that person. Like, I want to see them win. I want to help them. And that has been the consistent feedback that other people have given me. And then the last piece of that is you just got to follow through doing what you say you're going to do, being in an integrity, you know, being ethical. Those are the variables for making a very likable person. And wealthy people or successful people, they want to invest in other people that show them they're worthy of investing. And those things are an easy and consistent way that any single person can become more likable and get the right mentor in your world that just wants to help elevate you because they like you.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you talked a little bit earlier about like falling forward and falling fast, failing. Can you share some of like the favorite mistakes you've made along the way that have shaped you today? And maybe you didn't realize they were a mistake at the time or how much it shaped you.
I mean, partnership contracts are a big one. You know, I have, I've been in contracts and deals, you know, with, you know, either whether it's a seller or it's a partner, that, you know, when you are, I'm a very trusting person. And so when you're, you know, early on in your career and you're naive and you're just thinking that everybody has your best interest in mind, that's not always the case that I learned. And so those were expensive and hard lessons to learn, but they were amazing lessons to learn. Because, you know, those have just created more opportunity for me to grow and to bulletproof my processes and to be more, be more diligent in how I go about auditing relationships and opportunities. I think another big thing is, you know, checking your ego at the door every single day. And when you're going to enter a new opportunity or something that is, you know, bigger than something you've done before, past success doesn't always define or, you know, dictate future success. And so my challenges that I've run into in my career was just because I flipped 300 houses doesn't mean I can build a $2 million house on a hillside in Berkeley that ended up losing me $250,000 because I thought that I knew everything. I'm a house flipper when really, you know, I could have done a lot more due diligence and could have, you know, brought somebody in that knew way more than I did. And those were some of the things really that, you know, taught me early on, right? I'm a student of life and I'm always mm-hmm. looking for my next teacher. And the second I start thinking I know everything and got it all figured out, that's a dangerous place to be. And I learned that at an early age, fortunately, which has really served me in, you know, my real estate investing journey going forward.
Yep, absolutely. So on the prep call, you mentioned that doubling down on community is a huge part of your investment strategy. Can you share a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, community, like I said, masterminds has probably been the greatest accelerant and expander in my life. I've been a part of, you know, dad masterminds. I've been a part of marriage masterminds. I've been a part of, you know, real estate investing masterminds in all the niches. And so when you can tap into community, the right community is 1 + 1 = 100. And so whether that is, you know, I've had people literally, you know, invest in my deals that I wouldn't have been able to close otherwise if I wasn't a part of that community. I've had people share resources and relationships that were so critical to certain parts of my success. I've been able to learn and grow and to expand my mindset, you know, my business because of, you know, community. And I think now more than ever, right, people want to be aligned with other people that they know, like, and trust, that they can learn from, that they can be challenged by, that they can be held accountable by, and that can really ultimately, you know, elevate them. And so, you know, that's why I started my podcast. I mean, I've been able to raise tens of millions of dollars through my podcast because of community. People know, like, and trust me because they've heard my voice for the last 9 years while I've done my podcast. So those are things that, you know, I think some of the greatest opportunities and kind of diamonds are going to be in these smaller, intimate communities where you get to know people, that you get to understand what it is that they're working towards. They get to understand what you're working towards, and that, you know, that 1 + 1 = 10, you know, type of mentality. When you get around the right people that, you know, are aligned and congruent and working towards the same things and really want to bring value to one another, it can be a very, you know, exponential and compounding effect when it comes to achieving your goals. And that's something that we're going to continue to double down, you know, in our community and going forward. Because I think now more than ever, it's so easy to become isolated and to, you know, kind of fall into the narrative that you don't need some of those things. And and from my experience, it's been, you know, the opposite tenfold. And so we're really looking at, you know, continuing to create more opportunities for community and connection, not just from an interaction, you know, personal standpoint, how that, you know, lights the soul up, but also, you know, the power of a community, you know, is a great way to really get yourself to the next level in a much more expeditious fashion.
Yep, absolutely. What I'm hearing too is that it was really pivotal in your early stages of your career to be part of these mastermind groups. And it sounds like this has been an incredible opportunity too for you to kind of give back and help mentor people below you, you know, whether that's through these groups or through your podcast or through different avenues too, where you can just pour back into the community and kind of help build them how they've helped build you and continue to learn too.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, and the more you do it too, and the more you lean in, the results you get are validated, and therefore it just, it continues to kind of be gasoline poured onto the fire that you have burning within you. And not only, you know, I mean, money's great, don't get me wrong. I'm motivated by money, and wealth building and freedom was ultimately the number one thing that I was inspired by. I've unlocked a lot of it over the course of my real estate investing career, and I've really kind of redefined what wealth means to me. And a big component of wealth building and wealth achievement in my life is, you know, the currency of relationships. And so community is a very big part of, you know, that to me is an investment focus in my relationships and in my community, because not only has my business and my bank account benefited from it, but all the other categories and gardens of my life have benefited from it probably even more, because I am, you know, birds of a feather flock together. When you're around, you know, a lot of people that, you know, share in common values and are consistently taking action and are thinking big, you know, that exponential compound effect over time really validates the uncomfortable scenarios and situations that you put yourself in. And more you do that, you desensitize yourself to some of those fears. And so for me, it's constantly putting myself in spaces where I feel uncomfortable, but I know that I am surrounded by the right people that are going to force me and challenge me to, you know, elevate myself to that next level and achieve goals that kind of scare me a little bit. Yeah. And if you're not doing that, then I would highly encourage you. I always tell people, if you look at your goals or you look at your daily schedule or weekly schedule and it doesn't give you the pucker effect, pucker effect going, ooh, that makes me feel a little uncomfortable,
yeah.
Then you might want to revisit that. Because if you're telling yourself you want to live and achieve an extraordinary life and unlock extraordinary goals, then you got to be willing to go out there and do the extraordinary stuff on a daily basis. And that's going to be beyond what, you know, mediocre and average, you know, actions are looking like for most people on a daily basis. So putting yourself in those environments where your feet are held to the fire and you're held accountable and you're transparent and you're vulnerable, as uncomfortable as that is ultimately what I've learned gets the best out of me. And as a result of that, gets the best results for myself.
Yep, absolutely. Love that. I think one thing too that really shines through when you talk is just how passionate you are about everything that you're doing and everything that you've created and everything that you have looking forward to and, you know, the goals that you're working towards. And one thing I want to kind of highlight is you talk a lot about growth mindset and being intentional and being hardworking. And I think, you know, one other big avenue of that too is, you know, being very passionate about it. That's going to propel you forward. And when you talk about earlier, you mentioned, you know, maybe on paper, you're not the, you know, maybe you don't measure up as the absolute top in every category, but it comes down to hard work and those likability factors and also the passion too, because it's the person who's going to go the extra mile and make the extra call, but also the one that's going to, you know, enjoy doing it too. They're going to outwork all the rest.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, passion is a big part. I understand, because early on in my career, I did a lot of things that I was not passionate about. But there's a rite of passage, right? And I always ask myself is, you know, what does it take to earn the right to do X? Or what does it take to earn the right to unlock Y? And there's an answer for that. You know, if I want to go take, 3 months off and travel the world with my family, there's a formula for that, but I'm going to have to do things that have earned the right to unlock that type of freedom, right? And so even though there are things that I don't like doing, I'm a big believer in how you show up and the energy you bring is something that can make all the difference in the results you get and how quickly you get them. And my commitment was, even if I'm doing stuff that I really don't like doing, I can promise you that I'm going to show up with high energy every day. I'm going to give it my all, and I'm going to trust in where the results, you know, fall. And I think at the end of the day, every single person, whether you love what you're doing or not in that moment, has the ability to show up with a 10 out of 10 energy. And I can guarantee you that even the person who may be passionate about doing a, you know, a certain activity, but they're not bringing that energy every single day, I'll outperform that person too. Just because you like doing it doesn't mean that you're going to get better results than me. And therefore, I think energy, being an energy plant, being an energy consultant, being somebody that is constantly doing energy audits, when I am bringing the right energy and effort and focus to the activities that I'm doing, I'm trusting that I'm going to either get the results that I'm looking for, I'm going to get feedback on how I can do it a little bit better next time to unlock whatever that result is. And time again, it's all about, you know, repetition. I'm a believer that, you know, repetition is the mother of all success. And the more you do things, the better you're going to become at them, and you're going to unlock, you know, great results through that mastery. And the more energy you bring in that repetition, I think the quicker, at least from my experience, it is that you'll unlock those results.
And when you talk about too, you know, repetition and showing up, do you have any daily habits or practices that you like to incorporate, whether that's, you know, personal or career focused, that just kind of shape who you are and how you show up each day?
Yeah. I mean, when I went to one of my first masterminds, there were essentially 2 millionaires in this room. There were the millionaires. I mean, everybody in the room was financially killing it. But then there were the millionaires who were financially abundant in their bank account, but they were bankrupt with their wives. They were bankrupt with their kids. They were bankrupt with their health. They were bankrupt with their habits. And so for me, I went, man, I don't want to be like that person. But then I did notice on the other side, there was the millionaire who was financially killing it in their bank account, but they were just as purposeful and intentional and disciplined in their business as they were in their marriage, as they were with their kids, as they were with their employees, as they were with their health, as they were with their other categories that meant something really mm-hmm. important to them. And so when I started, that's ultimately why I started the Millionaire Mindcast. I left that that mastermind and said, I want to interview more people like that. I want to learn from them. I want to dissect their disciplines, their habits, their mindset, their path, and see how, based on my goals and the journey I'm on, that I can integrate in some of those stepping stones and take some of the breadcrumbs they're leaving on their trail and use that as fuel in my journey. And so one of the big things that I learned from most successful people is they track their habits, they journal, they meditate, right? They do all these things. One of my good friends, Hal Elrod, wrote The Miracle Morning. And that became something that I kind of became obsessed with for quite some time. And you know, I think everybody has a different routine and a rhythm. I don't think there is any specific, you know, format of what is the only way of doing it. And over testing and tweaking and reflecting over the years, I've just learned what works best for me. So I have a, you know, a basic morning routine that consists of my my journaling. It consists of, I have a habit tracker. I don't know if you can see up over, that's a planner that I actually created. That's called the Rich Life Planner, that got me very intentional and purposeful with how I track my habits, how I plan my schedule, and how I, you know, ultimately structure and execute on my day. And I'm just a framework guy. Like I said, I'm not that smart. But the right habits and the right frameworks are the bumpers to my bowling lane of life. And I want to make sure that I'm consistently knocking down strikes and spares, and therefore certain routines and certain disciplines allow me to do that. So I live and die by my calendar. If it's not in my calendar, it doesn't exist in my mind. And and ultimately, you know, I call it my family bunkers. Like in a war, guys would go and hide in a bunker because they knew they couldn't get sniped out of it. Well, we live in a world full of distractions that are sniping us left and right. So for me, I make sure that I build bunkers around time blocks of my priorities. Number one priority in my schedule is my family. So you won't be able to get a hold of me before 8 a.m. because I'm making my kids breakfast and I'm setting them up for homeschool for the day before I get into the office. And then I have my time blocks and my theme days throughout the week when I'm on the court of business. And then after 3:30, I'm going to the gym and making sure that that ultimately is, you know, my number one domino is my physical health and fitness, because mentally that gets me in a good space. Physically, mm-hmm. it keeps me in a good space, and vice versa. Those two play off of one another. And that big domino is ultimately what knocks over everything else when it comes to disciplines and habits. And then obviously the evenings, I've got my family bunker where I'm spending time with my kids and my wife and doing the things that we do. So I'm a big believer in calendaring and scheduling. And I do have a habit tracker in the planner. I have a digital habit tracker kind of on my screen. And again, this is just to come back to, I don't have some silver bullet that's going to make you more successful or make you, you know, more productive. What that framework does, though, is it just allows me to stay hyper aware of when am I crushing it and when am I off, and therefore what do I need to do to course correct, or what do I need to keep doubling down on and doing more of. So I have over time kind of created this formula for myself, which I call it just being weaponized, or, you know, a lot of people maybe recognize it as being in flow state. For me, I've identified by tracking so much data over the years of when I am most dangerous. And for me, that's when I'm consistently working out, I'm eating healthy and clean, I'm sleeping 7 to 8 hours a day, I'm putting good food into my body, I'm not drinking as much, I am getting quality time with my wife, I'm getting quality time with my kids, I'm making money and working on things that inspire me. And so I have figured out that, hey, I'm kind of in a funk right now. I feel like I'm kind of off. Oh, well, that's because you missed the gym 2 days in a row, or that's because you drank 3 days in a row with your friends on a snowboarding trip, right? So it's just created more awareness in my life. And I think anybody can figure out what disciplines and habits work best for keeping them in an optimal state.
Yep. I agree wholeheartedly too. And I think, you know, the more that you can show up for yourself and get yourself right, the better you can, you know, bring towards others.
Yep.
And sorry to put you on the spot a little bit here, but in one of your podcasts, you mentioned a routine that you do on Sundays with your family. If you don't mind sharing that, I thought it was really cute and I think our listeners would really enjoy it. Sounded like it was something that you guys do at the dinner table.
Yeah, so we have something that we call our relationship recharge. I actually got this from a marriage mentor of mine, that him and his wife would do something, what they called their family board meeting. And we kind of tweaked it and adjusted it a little bit to fit us. But I do this with my wife. I do this with my kids. And it's just three very simple questions. Every single week we ask, what did I do well this week? What could I have done better? And what do you have coming up this week that I can support you in? And instead of me assuming where I'm crushing it, which is, of course, all the time, I'm the best husband ever.
Of course.
It gives my wife space and feedback, you know, to tell me, hey, you did really good job this week. And it might be something that I didn't even know or think was important to her. And she's validating, hey, okay, cool. I should probably do a little bit more of that. Or, you know, where could I improve in? It's spotlighting, oh, I didn't know that hurt your feelings, or I didn't know that that, you know, bothered you, right? And then the last one is, you know, instead of me assuming that I need to do X and Y and Z to make sure that she's taken care of, it might just be X, right? Or it may be X, Y, and Z and A, B, and C too. And therefore, at least I'm clear. So it just creates this space of constant feedback for one of us, for the both of us to share with each other. And knowing that you have two people that are consistently committed to improving themselves and a relationship, whether that's two, you know, partners in a marriage, or in, you know, in a boyfriend and a girlfriend, or if it's, you know, parents and kids, it's just a space and an arena that now has created this cadence and rhythm of feedback. And I'm a big believer in just creating feedback loops, because the more feedback I can get, the more data that I can get, I just want to win. I don't always need to be right. And I think a lot of people, you know, hold themselves back because they want to be right and their ego gets in the way. I try and check my ego at the door every single day and just ask for feedback. Now, sometimes that feedback hurts, but at the same time, right, like the movie, you can't handle the truth. Like the truth is what will set you free. And if you really care about getting the best optimal outcome, you really care about winning in whatever context you're applying this to, then you need that feedback. You need that truth. And for me, I'm always seeking that. I'm always asking for it, because I know I'm willing to go and put in the work. So that's something that has created this really fun dynamic of feedback for my wife, for my kids. You know, where did dad, what did dad do well this week? What do you wish we dad would do more of? What do you wish dad would do less of? What do you have coming up this weekend that I can help you with? And my daughters love that now. And so it's great to get that feedback. And I think you can apply this anywhere. We do it now in our, you know, one-on-ones with our team members to get more, you know, insight on how they're doing and how we can better support them and what they're struggling with, things like that. So those are some of the things that are so simple. Three questions, 30 minutes, 15 minutes for each person. And it's just a great way to build a deeper bond, a deeper connection, and create more understanding in, you know, relationships that matter to you.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing that. I think it's a very powerful, you know, conversation to be having and questions to be asking. So I think our listeners would love that one.
Yeah, thank you for asking.
Yeah. So getting more into the nuts and bolts of our topic today, let's talk all things hospitality. So your focus specifically on boutique hospitality investment. So for those who might be unfamiliar, you know, what are those and what separates them from franchise hospitality operations?
Yeah, I mean, boutique is essentially just that. It's an unflagged boutique asset that is not beholden to a brand. So instead of, you know, a Holiday Inn Express or a Marriott or a Hilton, it's Play Park Lodge, it's the Firelight Lodge, it's the Jeffrey Hotel, right? It's just you having the freedom and flexibility to brand your asset the way you want, to run it the exact way you want, which obviously there's pros and cons with that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, I'm sure. But boutique is just having it be your own unique brand that you created and curated yourself. And you're not beholden to any corporate brand standards, systems or processes or covenants and restrictions in a lot of cases.
Interesting. And when you dive into, like, you know, the zoning and the tax differences, you know, can you talk about some of, like, the similarities and the differences between the two?
Yeah, I mean, the zoning and the tax differences don't really have anything to do specifically with whether it's a branded hotel or unbranded hotel. That's more specific to the state, the location, the market. So that wouldn't necessarily apply to whether or not it is, you know, zoning is going to be as mm-hmm. zoned as a hotel or not a hotel. Whether it's flagged or unflagged doesn't matter, right? And same thing on the tax side. You know, it's a hotel asset at the end of the day. That's the kind of the parent label. And then, you know, underneath that, right, is do you want to go flagged and be a part of a brand and have the team and the, you know, that brand recognition and the systems and the, you know, support? Or do you mm-hmm. want to kind of create your own brand? And do you want to create your own systems and your own operating team and have a little bit more freedom and flexibility to do that? But those branded or unbranded won't necessarily alter, you know, and apply when it comes to zoning and taxes.
Okay, thanks. And so when you look back at the sector too over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, how have you seen it evolve? Especially too with COVID coming into play.
Yeah, I mean, drastically. COVID definitely accelerated. I think hospitality is going through a little bit of a renaissance right now. You know, and we're already seeing a lot of the big brands now starting to come out with their own, what they call collection properties, right? Which is more boutique, one-off, you know, types of brands, a little bit more eclectic. Because I don't know about you, but you know, when you go and stay at a lot of these branded flagged assets, they mm-hmm. are pretty sterile, pretty boring. They're the same. Now, don't get me wrong, that can come with, you know, some quality standards and expectations, but it can also be very boring and not as exciting. And what we've seen over the course of the last few years, especially after COVID, is people want experiences. They want something cool and different and eclectic. And it doesn't need to be this massive, you know, hotel property or Hilton or Hyatt. They might want to stay at, you know, Don and Jesse's, you know, bunkhouse, and it's got this cool community tied to it, and it's got this cool experience tied to it. So I think mm-hmm. what we've seen is more and more people are looking outside of the normal run-of-the-mill hospitality assets that have once dominated for, you know, the last few decades. We're mm-hmm. now starting to see more and more people, at least from a consumer standpoint, seek those out. And therefore, actually big brands are over, specifically post-COVID, really starting to recognize that and have different collections underneath their flagged umbrellas mm-hmm. to create and meet, you know, the consumers where they're at and what they're looking for. And I think that's created a lot of cool utility and fun and creativity for smaller mom and pops and hoteliers that are looking to, you know, create really fun, unique, one-off experiences that a lot of these big brands and flags go, nah, that's not in our model. We don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, a lot of the you know, smaller investors and boutique hoteliers have the freedom and flexibility to do that. And their customers and the industry has really validated that there's a lot of momentum behind that.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to like the boutique hospitality, how do you think they've competed with upstarts like Airbnb? And, you know, where does the current landscape look like there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Airbnb is kind of like a feeder program into, you know, being a boutique hotelier, because I think it's gotten a lot of people outside of the mindset that I'm just going to rent my, you know, single family property for, you know, mm-hmm. a fixed base rent for 12 months and going, man, if I have an asset in Lake Tahoe that, you know, I could only rent out for $2,000 a month, or if I Airbnb it, I can make $5,000 a month. Right. That has really opened up the door to a lot of people to understand that hospitality and creating experiences for people can be a way to monetize and create higher returns. Now, of course, that comes with, you know, different challenges and opportunities. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen it now with the restriction of Airbnbs in a lot of markets where people bought assets, you know, underwriting them based on Airbnb numbers, not, you know, worst case scenario of if I can't Airbnb this house, I got to rent it out for a long-term tenant. Does the investment still make sense? And that's where I think a lot of people are getting caught right now. Because what have we seen all around the country? You know, big cities and in certain areas, they don't want people going to Airbnbs. They want people going to the hotels and the commercial cores and patronizing the businesses and spending their money in those areas instead of going and staying in the suburbs or, you know, so Airbnb is a great platform in a lot of ways, but you got to be careful about how you're analyzing your deals and you're looking at individual markets and the rules and regulations that come with those. And at the same time, we've seen, you know, it'd be a great stepping stone for a lot of people that are going, man, like, I actually really love creating experiences and I love the world of hospitality. And it is giving people more confidence to step into, you know, buying boutique hotels and kind of applying some of those same strategies in a single family, you know, one-off Airbnb asset into more of an ecosystem of assets underneath one roof. So I think a lot of mom and pops, there's so many boutique hotels all around the country that have been run by mom and pops that institutional investors are not interested in. They don't have the scale, they don't have the alignment, and therefore that's given a lot of freedom and opportunity for creative investors to look at some of these, you know, boutique hotels that are way outdated, that have no technology integrated into them, that have not been, you know, operationally top graded, to come in and bring in some of the prop tech that has made, you know, running these properties a lot easier, that has made, you know, creating systems and creating brands a whole lot easier to make properties that are very outdated and underperforming actually, you know, really cool experiences and assets and make financial sense on paper.
Sure. So when you talk about this shift too, you know, what capital do you think is, you know, operating and also entering into the hospitality space? And how do you think that's also shifted?
Yeah, I mean, I think institutional level capital at the end of the day is always going to be looking for scale. And so they're not going to play under a certain price tag. And generally that's 10 mil and under. So when you look at family offices, private equity groups, hedge funds, they're going for the larger assets. And generally, they're going to play in the flag space because they know that these branded assets with these branded models, with these systems, standards, and expectations that are required in order to be under that flag, that's going to spit out a certain, generally a certain return. And therefore, it's a little bit safer of an investment for them. It's going to get the yield that they're looking for. And so that's the space that they're going to play in, which is really great for the 10 million and under investor, the mom and pop investor that wants to go in and use these smaller assets to be canvases of their creativity and creating experiences and creating great, you know, wealth building vehicles for them. I mean, I call boutique hotels the trinity of real estate because you can get the cash flow. It's a hard, tangible asset, right? That has obviously all the benefits of tax depreciation and equity growth. But then there's this other component of it, which is I have so many priceless memories with my daughters at all of my hotels and all of the fun trips that we've taken and stayed at my hotels. Those are things that I cannot do. I'm not going to take my girls to tour the liquor store in, you know, one of my strip centers or, you know, go into the laundromat to, you know, let's go have some fun today. No, but I can say, let's go up to the, you know, I have to have a couple of meetings and then let's go to the beach after and let's go get some pizza at the Village. And right, like those are memories and experiences that the ROI is priceless on. So that's why I love hospitality assets is not only can I get all the benefits of commercial real estate, but I can also get experiences out of them. And for me, what I have, you know, learned about myself as I've unlocked, you know, more wealth personally is I would much rather trade memories and experience or trade making money or more money for experiences and memories with my, you know, my family and my kids and my loved ones. But if you compare those together, that's where it gets really sexy and fun. And so that's what I love about commercial real estate is, you know, you get all of those benefits of, you know, equity growth, taxes, and, you know, cash flow. But then when you layer in this hospitality component, there's this experiential side of things that you just can't get in any other real estate asset class. And that has been something that we've really leveraged and just had so much fun with when it comes to our family and our friends and using, you know, hotels as a cool way to, you know, check all of those boxes.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So for our listeners too, they're trying to understand, you know, what makes the most sense for them and where they fall into, whether it's boutique, you know, or, you know, big flag. Can you help kind of outline the pros and cons of each?
Yeah, I mean, I think, as I kind of mentioned before, you know, hotels that are flagged, they come with a proof of concept already, right? Mm-hmm. Like at the end of the day, most people that are investing in flagged hotels know that they're going to get a 20% net profit margin if you follow these systems and you have this team and you tap into this training and you use our back office for this and you uphold these brand standards, you're essentially going to spit out a 20% net profit margin at the end of the day. Now, there are rules and restrictions about and covenants in those management and those brand agreements that, you know, might, you know, curb some of your creativity and some of the fun things that you want to do on the property. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you need to be aware of. On the other side, right, boutique hospitality is an open and blank canvas for you to let. I mean, every single hotel that I've, you know, bought and purchased, we've redone the brands, we've redone the FF&E, we've relaunched the operational systems, we rebuilt the teams, we've had to restabilize these assets, which comes with, you know, a lot of upside, but also comes with a lot of challenges too. And so those are things that you just need to be aware of. And I think it all depends on what are your goals? What are you looking to accomplish? When do you want to accomplish them by? And you know, operating is such a challenging part of hotels. And if mm-hmm. you're not a good operator, because at the end of the day, like when I bought my first hotel, it's like, oh, I'm going to flip this, you know, this hotel, just like I flipped all these houses, and it's going to be easy and great. I know how to turn a turd into something beautiful. What I didn't realize was it was a full-time living, breathing organism and business. 24/7, 365, you have people coming and going inside your property. You have staff mm-hmm. coming and going inside your property. You got to manage people, whether those are your customers or your team. And so it was this full-time operating business. And I essentially had to build that from the ground up, where we were the management company that was managing and operating these assets. Because right. we all know that, you know, the income you generate from your real estate is tied to the value of it. So if you're not a good operator, you don't have a good operator in place, you don't have those brand standards, you don't have those systems, you don't have that team, that can be a very big challenge for a lot of small mom and pop boutique operators. The other side of it is, you know, if you're somebody that just kind of wants to be hands off and, hey, I'm willing to make a little bit less, but I know I can tap into all of these systems and resources and people and this brand standard that's already there, I don't need to reinvent the wheel. You know, that can be a benefit, but obviously there's, you know, cons with that too. So just understanding what is on both sides of that fence and what your level of involvement and activity and risk tolerance and, you know, commitment looks like are things that can, you know, help weigh into what path might make most sense for you.
Sure. Thanks for helping outline those two. And then if we were to isolate kind of the ROI perspective, you know, what do you think the advantages are there? And also with that too, you know, what do you think the current obstacles are for investors?
I mean, the brand standards on the flagged assets, your net, well, it's an interesting, because if you're a really strong operator, you know, you can pull 30% in net profit margins out of a boutique hotel, where you may not be able to do that in a flag brand, because the brand standards of what they expect and what those operating right. expenses tie to only spits out a certain amount of money at the end of the day. So mm-hmm. I think, again, it just comes back to, you know, who is the manager and operator of the assets. At the same time, you know, the flagged assets are generally going to have a little bit higher of a barrier of entry. There's not to be said you can't find flagged assets at a very, you know, favorable price point in certain markets. Mm-hmm. But in the markets that I was looking at and very interested in, you know, the barrier of entry was a lot higher for a flagged asset than it was for an unflagged asset, which is ultimately what led me into, you know, sticking in the boutique side of the space.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. So switching gears a little bit. You are a huge proponent of content and social media marketing, and you've made a big splash in the sector with really successful results. So when did you decide to start creating content and eventually expand your content offerings?
I started investing in my personal brand like back in 2015, and I went pretty hard on it Which is where I saw most of my growth, honestly, from like 2015 to like 2019. And then as I was just heads down on building, you know, the first hotel and then the second and the third, I was so heads down on building the business and the team and the brand that I really kind of started, you know, going away from my social media and my personal brand. I was still doing the podcast. I've been doing that for 9+ years. And so that was always kind of a consistent way to keep, you know, awareness and build trust and add value. And we, you know, are consistently putting out content from that perspective. But for the, you know, 15 to 19, I mean, I was putting out vlogs and videos and content every single day. And what I can say was it was such a massive benefit when you're authentic and you're just being yourself and you're doing it for the right reasons. It became this magnet that attracted other people that shared in that same kind of approach and value, that it allowed me to build my network of accredited investors who wanted to invest in my deals. It allowed me to get more deal flow. I mean, that first hotel literally was brought to me by a complete stranger just because they'd been following me on Instagram for a year and they knew I was in this area and they knew I was interested in, you know, those kind of things. And so, like, you just never know where the next opportunity, the next relationship is going to come from. And I'm just a big believer in all it takes is one. All it takes is one, you know, real estate deal to change your life. All it takes is one relationship or conversation to change your life. All it takes is one, whatever, insert X, to completely put you on a new and different path. And when you can give people a window into your life, who you are, what you stand for, how you think, what actions you're taking, it is such a cool way to build a bridge, to give people an opportunity to say, hey, Taylor, I love what you're doing. Like, I'd love to connect with you. Hey, Taylor, you've got this going on in your life. I have something that might be of interest to you. Like, if you don't put yourself out there, it's a very limiting thing. And I knew that I have always kind of been called to, you know, bring value to other people and put myself out there and make myself feel uncomfortable, even though sometimes I don't like the way I sound or look or, you know, all of the reasons that everybody has for not creating content. Anytime I feel fear, and I think most entrepreneurs feel this way. Anytime you feel fear, to me, it's a call to action. It's like, I need to lean into this. And if anything, it's kind of a call to adventure, because I know I'm going to have, you know, so many learnings and peaks and valleys, but I know and trust that if I give it my all, that I'm going to get the results that I want and, or I'm desiring, and it's only just a matter of time. And so content has been a really amazing way to bring value to other people. I mean, my podcast has been downloaded in every country in the world. I've had people from all over the globe tell me how I've changed their life. And to me, that was so validating and so humbling, honestly. And so I just think about all the people in the world that have so much value to give, but there's these little stupid fears that we let overtake ourselves from, you know, taking action that could completely transform somebody's life. So I just am of the mindset that all it takes is one, and content and putting yourself out there and just, you know, giving value to other people is the best way to accomplish that, but also to give yourself the best chance to continue to elevate in the process.
I love that answer, Matt. And it's interesting too, because a lot of the guests that we brought on the podcast say very similar things too. And, you know, there's a theme of really humanizing things. And that's how people want to relate to you. And especially in an industry and, you know, real estate, where it's not boiler room sales, it's relationship building, and really bringing value to other people too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when it comes to educating your listeners, you know, what is it, that encourages you to, you know, take so much time creating your resources? And what is most important to in the message that you want to bring across to them?
I mean, I think just being real, you know, in a highlight real world that we live in now, and oftentimes, unfortunately, you know, very fake and facade driven world that we live in now, everything that I do, I just want it to be authentic and genuine. With the intention, my underlying intention with everything I do is this going to bring value to people? Because if it's not, then, you know, it's really more of a self-serving focus. And so for me, my team, everything we do, we want to do it with the intention of how can we deliver value, and know that when that is the number one intention behind everything you do, you can trust in where the results land. And so that is kind of the one simple focus of everything we do. Now, of course, there's always some strategy behind, you know, how to get the best, you know, outcome, or how to reach the most people, or mm-hmm. how can we add value and how can it still help us in the process? But at the end of the day, like, the intentions need to be good. If it's just, I want to make, you know, a bunch of money off of these people, and how can I trick them into believing that I'm rich and famous and I've got this car or this house, like, that just was never me. It was something that didn't resonate with me. And mm-hmm. therefore, I knew that it's kind of like the four tires of your car. When one tire is out of alignment, the ride is not going to be smooth. It's going to be bumpy, and you're just going to know something's off and it's not going to feel right. But when mm-hmm. everything is aligned, it's just so easy. It's so smooth, and it's almost, it's very authentic and organic and easy to drive. And so that was kind of my approach of going, anything we do, I just want it to be organic and aligned with my values, who I am, and who I want to serve. And that's the beauty, is I'm not here to serve everybody. You guys aren't here to serve everybody. The person listening, whatever content you put out, is not to serve everybody, but there is somebody that you want to reach. There is an avatar that you want to make an impact with. So keeping that avatar in mind with what you create, making sure it's a valuable, you know, and an aligned, you know, resource for them, it makes the curation of that content and creating that content so much easier.
Sure. And so it sounds like, too, you know, your main focus and when you put out content is you really want to bring value to your listeners or, you know, readers. So how do you choose your topics? And kind of a second part with that, too, is, you know, how much, you know, audience interest and audience feedback kind of informs those topics you put out. I know you mentioned earlier it's all about a feedback loop, whether that's with your family or what you bring into, you know, business meetings or with your team as well. So how does that all kind of jumble together?
It's really important to get the feedback, right? Because I think at the end of the day, when you ask people to be engaged and involved, that call to action is a way that you're creating community and connection with people. And so my podcast, I came up with the Millionaire Mindcast not because I came up with it, but because I polled all the people that were supporting me and following me, mm-hmm. and I asked them, what content would they want? What do you think about this brand? As I was launching the show and we were trying to figure out the show artwork, these three logos, which one do you like the most? And people want to have DNA in something that they feel like they're a part of. And so engaging your audience and allowing them to be a part of your journey and what you're building and what you're sharing and putting out is a really great way to get people to feel included in that journey. And so for me, that's something that I'm constantly, you know, looking for feedback. And then, you know, on the other side of it too, is I think it's just really important to consistently make sure that what you're putting out is truly aligned with you, the curator. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if I'm trying to talk on things that just because I listened to a podcast or I read a book on it, but I don't have that feeling of experience or intimacy with it, I feel incongruent. And again, going back to alignment, I want to talk about things. I don't want to just be a messenger. We have too many of those right now in the world, in my opinion. Yeah. I want to live my message at the highest level and speak from experience. Mm-hmm. I want my message to be me and to be around the things that I know I can talk to from experience. So I really don't talk about a lot of things that I, one, don't have experience in, that I'm not passionate about. And oftentimes, pretty much a lot of the content, I kind of focus on three core pillars is, you know, the business side, the entrepreneurship side, the investing mm-hmm. and wealth building side. And then I focus on the motivation side because those are things that have inspired me along my journey. And then the third piece of it is I focus on my personal life and my family side. Because I'm not just about business and entrepreneurship and making money. I'm not just about trying to hype people up and be motivated and, you know, impact their mindset. And I'm not just about, you know, my family and my personal life and adventures and being a dad and being a husband. I'm all of those things. So I want people to get a reflection of who I am authentically in all areas of my life. And that was the personal brand I chose to build. Now, I know people that are just like, hey, I'm talking personal finance and personal finance only. And that's totally fine too. I know people that don't even want anyone to know they have a family or to have an insight into what their family is doing and what they're believing. Yep. We made a choice as a family my wife and I did to say, hey, you know what? We want to align and attract authentic, integrity-driven, ethical, awesome people that are just as purposeful and passionate about business and making money as they are about their kids and their marriage, traveling and having fun, you know, being motivated and making a positive difference in people's lives. And that's what I created as the building blocks and foundation for my personal brand and the content that I put out. Whether somebody else decides to do something different, that's totally fine, right? Just understanding what do you want people to see and get and feel when they interact with your brand. And maybe that's not even your own personal brand. That might just be a business brand. But I think that's really important to get clarity on, because then it becomes much easier to curate content that's in those veins and just continue to mine there.
Mm-hmm. So with that too, do you use much data to kind of inform your social strategy or content angles?
Yeah, I mean, we again, I'm not that smart. So I just use feedback, and honestly, data is one of the best ways. So we have, you know, KPIs and dashboards that we track with all of our data. And, you know, if something's working really well, it becomes that much easier to double down on it and to tweak and adjust if it's not working so well, and to split tests. And so, yes, we are very into the mechanics of what's working, what's not, you know, understanding what the KPIs are in context to whatever it is that you're tracking is, I think, very important. And just using that data and consistently reflecting on that data to, you know, try and get better results. So I do, you know, have my social media team and my digital team constantly tracking stuff. And then obviously the other side of it too is a lot of the content that I put out is data on macroeconomics of what the Fed is doing, is what's going on in the market. What are the average price per square foot? What are days on, right? So like that data is very important when I'm trying to share and give insights into tactical stuff that has to do with, you know, wealth building or this market or this investment strategy. So I'm a big believer in data. I think the more data points you have up on the board, the easier it is to see clues and to connect dots and to figure out, you know, if you want to skate to where you think the puck is going. And data is just a great way to, you know, give yourself a little bit more of an edge to get a better result and to give more value and to take the next right step, depending on what it is that you're, you know, looking at.
Sure. And we talked a lot, you know, throughout the podcast too, about how you've had different lessons that shape you along the way, different learning experiences. So when it comes to the podcast, what are some of the most surprising, you know, learnings you've discovered in establishing your brand, and anything you've had to kind of overcome?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to record today. You know, I didn't like the way I sounded. That episode barely got any downloads. What the heck? The other side of it, right, is there have been so many amazing things. Like, I get to meet Taylor today. I would have never met Taylor if I didn't get on this podcast. I had started with an accredited investor list of about, I think, 60 people when I first started my podcast. And as it started to grow, I started doing more call to actions of, hey, if you want to look at, you know, passive income opportunities that I put out to my exclusive network, text the word deals to 844-447-1555. 5 years later, I have over 1,000 accredited investors and have raised tens of millions of dollars for real estate deals. And I mean, I've literally gotten on the phone with people where I've got an offering out and I'm like, okay, so here's the deal and blah, blah, blah. And we're running through it. Like, no, like, just tell me where to wire the money. I'm like, wait, what do you mean? Like, I've been listening to you for 5 years, dude. I already know you. I already like you. I already trust you. I've seen you take this deal and close it out here and have your, so like this ability to build trust and rapport with people at scale is so powerful through social media and through, you know, podcasting. And then just obviously, you know, getting the messages and the emails that you get from people of, I bought my first deal and I retired my wife, or I did this with, you know, vacation with my family because you, you know, showed me how to do this strategy, which may, so those are the types of things that again are just validating and reaffirm why you're, you know, doing the things that you're doing. So of course, strategy around how I can continue to grow my business, my network, you know, my brand through the podcast. But even more importantly, the impact that you putting yourself out there and creating content and sharing, you know, podcasts and things like that, it's pretty special. And, you know, one day we just hit 9 years, over 1,000 episodes on the Millionaire Mindcast, and those episodes will live on forever. When I die one day, My girls can pull it up and listen to it. They can share it with their kids, right? Who knows what impact you're going to make outside of this short-term kind of mindset that most of us have. So again, going back to the crockpot mindset, that's what I do. I do everything with the long-term in mind, trusting that if I do the right things over an extended period of time, it's going to compound into something very special. And that's what I'm doing. I'm just playing this long marathon with little strategic sprints along the way and trying to be as aware as I possibly can to tweak and pivot to optimize what results I'm getting as I do it.
Yep. It's got to be so impactful too, you know, as you put out these podcasts and you put out your voice more and more, to just see it come back in different ways, the business. Like you mentioned that that's how you got one of your first deals, just because they had heard about you. They resonated with what, you know, you were putting out and felt like it would be a great deal for you. And then similarly too, you know, the trust is already built. So when you're talking deals, sounds like they're ready to just wire you the money. So that's incredible. And I know, you know, the word that's really resonated through all this is just being authentic. And it sounds like that's been the core, like, building block when you put out your message. So when it comes to, you know, brokers and investors that are going to try to brand themselves, you know, how can they, what tangible steps can they take, or where would you advise that they kind of kick things off?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just, it comes back to is, who are you trying to reach and serve, and what kind of value can you give them authentically that is based on your own experience and expertise? And I mean, I know you guys just had, I believe, Tyler Cobble on. Tyler is awesome. I love him. I love the content that he puts out. I love who he serves. I love how he does it. And he is a broker. And he is obviously a big investor as well. But just because of the content that he's put out and what he's excited about and what he's passionate about and what's going on in his community and his market, now all of a sudden, he's been elevated to this status and this authority as being a true leader inside of his community and his industry. And that in itself has opened up so many doors for investments, for groups that are going, this is the best dude in Nashville. Like, I got to get to working with him. So thinking about how you can put out content that is relevant and interesting in your space is one thing, but also how you're putting out the content and what you're sharing. Do you want to be, you know, somebody that comes off as arrogant and slimy, or do you want to be somebody that comes off as humble and kind and serving? So I think it's there's so much opportunity now, and the barrier of entry to creating content is so easy, whether it's with ChatGPT and AI and Canva and all the cool tools that are just so simple and easy to use now. It's who do you want to attract, and how do you want to be perceived by those people? And then thinking about where they're starting at and where you can take them, that can help you identify working backwards on a roadmap that might shed a little bit more light and spotlight the content and the value that you want to create as an individual as you build your brand.
Sure. And so, since tactical insights play such a key role in your output, what are some of the key topics that you're focused on helping your audience with today, especially amid, you know, shifting macroeconomic factors?
Yeah, I mean, my thing is I like to keep it simple. And that's why I've got, you know, my real estate investment mastermind, the Wise Investor Collective. Is our core focus in that mastermind group is to help people identify what their buy box criteria is on one commercial real estate asset that nets them 50K a year, and how do you build a model that allows you to go out there and achieve that goal for 5 years in a row. And so that's what our content and a lot of the data and a lot of the tools and a lot of the resources and a lot of the templates and a lot of the trainings are all around that. And when you have one clear outcome in mind and you niche down in that, it becomes so much simpler to create value and content and support and actually get people results than being like, hey, I'm gonna help you buy this $1 million asset that's in this category, and I'm going to help you buy this $10 million asset that's in this category, but a lot of different strategy. Like, I get it. Chasing many rabbits is fun, but it often leads to nothing sitting on the dinner table. And I'm, trust me, I'm one of those for, in my journey early on in real estate, I mistaked movement for achievement. I was really busy. I was working 80, 90, 100 hours a week. But it wasn't until I got really clear on this is my North Star, mm-hmm. this is what I'm moving towards, and here's when I want to be there by, then it becomes so much easier to get clear on what those stepping stones and milestones are and getting there. And therefore, you know, a 5-lane freeway comes down to a fast lane and it's so much easier. I'm sure most people can, you know, relate to this, is it's never an issue with work ethic. It's mm-hmm. are you working on the right things? And so when you can get clear on what those right things are, it becomes so much easier to say no to the stuff that's a distraction, to double down and say yes to the stuff that is. And therefore, it's going to be so much easier to, you know, accelerate getting the results that you're looking to get.
Mm-hmm. So what would you say, like, what key investment principles remain tried and true during uncertain times?
Oh, I mean, there's so many. It's funny. I have this list of, like, I have created a list of 25 real estate rules and laws of success that I'm going to pass on to my kids one day. I think when I look at, you know, a handful of things on this list, number one is, you know, real estate cash flow is freedom. Equity means you have options. But at the end of the day, you can't eat your equity. You can't, you know, your cash flow puts food on the table. It keeps, you know, your bills paid. It really does unlock freedom. And so I believe that, you know, there's got to be a balance between that. But, you know, cash flow is king, and you know, equity and your balance sheet is oftentimes more aligned with giving you more options. And oftentimes it's, you know, net worth is more associated with ego. When most people at the end of the day just want freedom. So I'm mm-hmm. a big believer in buying for cash flow. The other thing is, you know, I'm a big believer in when your return on equity, you know, drops really low, I like to exchange up and use that equity to go and buy more cash flow and just play that, you know, swap till you drop 1031 game. I think that's a really important, you know, law for a lot of people. I think right now what we're seeing is when the market shifts and turns, a lot of people are getting caught right now in a really big way. And the reason is they overleveraged or they underwrote to a blue sky versus a worst case scenario. And I'm a big mm-hmm. believer in underwriting to worst case scenario always, and hoping for the best, but planning for the worst. And we're seeing right now a lot of people are getting caught with interest rates where they're at, adjustable rate mortgages and cap rates expiring and things like that. That's a quick way to lose your entire net worth and all the hard work that you've put in. So for me, I am just again saying I've got my consistent cash flow portfolio that is more of legacy, long-term, you know, freedom growth. And I'm not worried about how, you know, much the equity grows in that. And then I have certain assets that this is a value add play. We're looking to force as much equity into this asset as possible. It's going to be a little bit riskier. And finding a balance of what that looks like in your portfolio is a great way to continue to grow your wealth without putting yourself in a position that might take it all down.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think I know the answer to your question or to the question here, but why is now a good time to invest into the commercial real estate industry, or is it?
Oh, it's always a good time, right? I mean, at the end of the day, in good markets and bad markets, I've found home run deals. So there is always a great deal out there. It's just shifted depending on what, you know, the macroeconomic picture looks like. But in times like right now, based on where we're at in the economic cycle, and I think a lot of people who, you know, follow the Crexie podcast can leverage your guys' data to see that there's a lot of distress mounting in the market right now. And, you know, I've always been a contrarian, you know, thinker, a contrarian mover. And when most people are fearful, I'm actually leaning in. And I think right now is one of the best times to be setting up your systems, to be building deeper relationships mm-hmm. with brokers, to be talking more with sellers, to be getting more reps, analyzing and underwriting deals and getting comfortable with certain markets, because you want to dig the well before you want to scoop the water. And when the market is hot and everything is on fire, well, guess what? It's probably too late. So mm-hmm. you want to get in and do these things earlier. And I always just say I'm a farmer of relationships. So I'm consistently planting seeds every single day. I'm consistently watering those relationships. And you know what's crazy is, you know, 15 years later, looking up after doing that, and I look at my farm of relationships, there's a lot of crops that have fruit bearing. And that's one of the best things that you can do consistently, whether the market is good or bad, is to build relationships with people who are in the trenches, on the front lines, talking with sellers, doing deals, and every mm-hmm. once in a while, right, they're going to have an opportunity that fits into your world. And that's all we're looking for, is just one opportunity a year. And you do that consistently enough, you're going to have a really big farm of quality relationships that are going to create great opportunities for you. So do I think right now is the best time to invest in real estate? Yes, I do. I think now is the season of seller finance. And there are great opportunities. I just closed on a commercial medical office building that on paper, if I had to go and leverage debt at the interest rate that it's at right now, at the loan to value that the bank would have given me, I can't make that deal make sense. But this mm-hmm. seller was motivated to make the deal happen and they needed to sell. And I got favorable seller financing terms, unlike anything most people have ever seen in their life from a bank, better than 3.75 interest rate. So there's so many ways to get creative with people in times like right now when resources and scenarios are very limited in capacity on how you can make a deal work. It's the creative mm-hmm. people that are willing to lean in and find a way to create a win-win that are going to create those home run opportunities when most people are sitting on the sidelines saying that they can't make these deals work. I'm out there going, how can we make these deals work? You don't find deals in these kind of markets, you make deals in these kind of markets. So getting creative is the underlying strategy that most people are scared to do. And mm-hmm. some of the best deals are done in that arena.
Absolutely. Thanks for sharing there. All right. So looking at the time, how do you feel about a couple more little fun questions? Or is just
three quick questions? Let's do it.
First off, if you were given $50 million today and had to invest it immediately, what would your go-to asset type be, location, and why?
I would park $25 million into a hotel asset in a luxury leisure market that has tourism year round and is something that I could go and enjoy with my family and has obviously a stabilized operation. Brandon is in a phenomenal location. It doesn't really matter whether it's Lake Tahoe, whether it's Dubai. I would park it in an A+ tier one market. And then the other $25 million, I would diversify into some type of value add asset that would probably be in the multifamily space, just for the sole fact that, you know, shelter, multifamily, it's not going mm-hmm. anywhere. You get it in these, you know, tier one A location markets, and you have, you know, really quality operations in place. Those would be the two. The last one maybe that I would throw in there would be to, you know, take some of that capital and put it into a triple net credit grade tenant like a Starbucks or one of those really strong, you know, companies that you just mm-hmm. know you never need to worry about them paying. I mean, if those companies go down, something's going bad in the world. So that's a good way to, you know, protect your assets and to make it as passive as you possibly can in those, you know, triple net type of credit grade tenants.
And what is your favorite tool or software that you use on the job? We promise this is not a trick question.
To be honest, I mean, this is not a biased or a forced answer. I love Crexie's platform in terms of how you guys have made it just so easy to get access to data and to comps and to information. Yeah. So it's really become, you know, probably the tool of the office that everybody loves using the most and consistently. I would say the other one is ChatGPT. I mean, every mm-hmm. single person on our team uses ChatGPT, needs to know how to use it. We leverage it. I would say personally, I use Google 80% less and ChatGPT that much more in so many different ways, from marketing campaigns to building out Excel spreadsheets to creating checklists to so many different facets of, you know, of real estate and the value that, you know, using ChatGPT as a personal mm-hmm. assistant to build out those processes has become something we've really leveraged at a high level.
Awesome. Well, Matt, thank you for joining us and sharing your insights. I know you're very busy, so we appreciate you spending the time to sit down with us. Where can people find you online if they want to get in touch?
My easiest way is, you know, on all the social channels, at official Matty A, M-A-T-T-Y-A is the best place. They can always go listen to 3 episodes a week of Millionaire Mindcast on all podcasting platforms, or you can always check out wiseinvestorcollective.com or matthaitchison.com and reach out to me there.
Perfect.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/Crexie for video recordings of each episode. For a full list of episodes and show notes, visit crexie.com/podcast. That's crexi.com/podcast. And sign up to get the very next episode delivered straight to your inbox. Take care, and we'll see you next time.